The Discover Ag podcast is brought to you by Case IH. Case IH has solutions for every challenge, equipment for every farm. Case IH is built by farmers.
You're listening to a 58 Ember production.
Good morning, Discovering Discos. This week, we discover the many polarizing and inspiring lives of Martha Stewart, luxury fruit that costs close to $1,000, and how Lunchables are under fire for concerning reports of lead.
Welcome to Discover Ag, where food meets pop culture. We're your hosts, Natalie and Tara, millennial cattle rancher and dairy farmer, and every Thursday, we take you beyond the headlines to discover what's new in the world of food. And you started your teaser with that we're covering Martha Stewart, but what you didn't say is it's actually not an article, it's a documentary. And so it's a little different for us, just like a little bit of a turn of events. You know, we're usually like newspaper girlies, and now we're doing a TV series.
I know, but we've covered A Farmer Wants a Wife before, and I think we're going to cover, the McBee brothers or McBee dynasty. So, I mean, we're in it. We're in the thick of it, whether it's in the news or on the TV or Netflix. We're on it.
Well, what I was going to say is, this fall, when we did our fall ins and outs, I had almost completely given up TV. Like, no joke, was not watching TV. And then lately, actually, I blame it fully on Giggly Squad. They have been giving TV recommendations that are out of this world. I actually am posting one of them in the Discover newsletter. So shout out Club Discover. Go sign up because I'm giving some recommendations of some great shows that I've been watching. But one of their recommendations was this Martha Stewart documentary, and it did not disappoint.
No, it did not disappoint at all. I do have to give you a hard time, though, because you know I am the one that puts the newsletter together. And I do swear every single week you send me something that you're watching. I'm like, oh, Tara watched another show this week. Oh, we got another show this week.
I know, it's been terrible. I like need to get back in that October mindset where TV was out for me and I wasn't watching it. But at the same time, like this one and then the one I just recommended in the newsletter, I'm like, I'm glad I didn't miss these. Like, I needed to watch these.
It was definitely worth watching. And I think on that note, let's just dive right into it because I do have a lot I want to say about it. I have a lot to say about Miss Martha.
I do as well. So kick it off for us. What are we covering?
Okay, so first kind of semi-article to discover this week. Headline, The Many Lives of Martha Stewart, Influencer, Inmate, Icon. So as Tara said, this is a recap of the CNN original series, The Many Lives of Martha Stewart, which traces basically Stewart's explosive rise to success, her staggering fall from grace, and her momentous comeback to the limelight.
I think I went into this thinking about Martha, like the Martha Stewart we knew in the 1990s, like the person who is cooking and showing us tablescapes. But this really went so much deeper. I mean, it was like the good and the bad and the ugly of Martha Stewart's life. But I left thinking, oh my gosh, this woman is so much more than what we think she is. Like, she is absolutely incredible.
Oh, it was a riveting roller coaster for sure. I loved it. I personally, my like big takeaway is I felt like it was, I guess maybe empowering. I mean, I love to see a trailblazer, and that's definitely what Martha was. It's funny because I don't know if I would have called her that just because we didn't really grow. We weren't her target audience. I grew up with her. So it's hard to say like I didn't grow up with Martha, but we just weren't of the age to like understand, I guess, and like comprehend her success. So I would never have classified her as a trailblazer, but holy mackerel. She's like the OG trailblazer almost.
I put in my notes, she's like the OG influencer. Like, she was in.
Yes.
Long before influencing was even a word or a thought of a word. Like, what she did is crazy. Like, from her rise to her fall to just all aspects of her. But actually, what I probably knew the least about was her beginning stages, like where she started out. And I thought it was crazy. She started modeling at 13. And I was, that's really young to have like a job that you have to go to, which I understand this was like back in the day, but at the same time, this was back in the day where like women did not work outside of the home. And so at 13 to be like, I'm going to go and sign with a modeling agency and get a job. I thought that was pretty incredible.
Yeah. And she used it to pay for her college tuition, which I think is, you know, kudos to her. I mean, she is very educated, very intelligent. You know, I think going back to how I was just talking about how she's a trailblazer, I think she's had this like sense of confidence instilled from her from a very young age. And I think it shows in like from the very beginning modeling and through the rest of the progression too, because her next step was being a stockbroker, shocking enough.
I know, which is even crazier when you see, like, obviously the downfall of her career for a while was like insider trading, which we'll get to. But the fact she was a stockbroker was wild to me. I mean, she married a law student from Yale at 19, finished college, became a stockbroker, became a mom. Part of her reminded me, you have a saying where you say always confident and sometimes wrong. What do you say?
This is what Luke says about me.
I was thinking this about Martha.
He says that I'm often wrong, but never in doubt.
I feel like for some reason, part of me felt like this summed up this documentary on Martha Stewart, that she was like wrong maybe a few times, but like never in doubt. Utter confidence.
No. Miss Martha was not going to admit to anything when we get into her downfall, which is part of the reason why she had such a spiraling downfall, is because she wouldn't just like suck it up and, I don't know, admit that she's wrong or admit a couple different things, which I know we'll get to that in a second, but gosh, crazy.
Yeah. And her stockbroker career was not small. Like, she was making really good money, over six figures in the 70s in a very like anti-woman industry. And so it just seems like such a turn of events to go from being a stockbroker. Then she was a caterer, and then she started doing cookbooks, and like, you know, we can move on from there. But like, her stockbroker career is like worth noting.
Yeah, she said that that job taught her so much about what it takes to build a real business, a real company, a meaningful and useful enterprise. And I think it is so interesting that, again, how I would never have called her a trailblazer, but this is a perfect example of how in each segment of her life, like her teens, her 20s, her 30s, her 40s, her 50s, even now into her 80s when she was like 81 and on the cover of Sports Illustrated, she has always trailblazed in her individual industry. Like you said, she was part of the stockbroker when women were not like on in, I would say, kind of the office. Like they weren't, I mean, they weren't even, to say they weren't in the office is like an underestimation, because they weren't anywhere on, I would say, like Wall Street or in that like world. And here, like you said, Martha was dominating. And I think it's interesting because she's obviously very driven, but it came at such a cost to her, right? Because one thing the documentary really focused on, or I guess I should say like series really focused was on, is her marriage and her daughter and how she kind of did not show up in her personal life because she was so focused and driven in her professional.
Yeah, so backing up just a little, she ended up leaving Wall Street. She moved into an old farmhouse that her and her husband like redid. During that time, I feel like is when she found her like love of homemaking. I mean, they like, you know, restoration of like the original hardwood floors, like very back to what it was in its prime. And then just even the photos of her in that farmhouse with like all the pots hanging from the ceilings.
Like, oh, I loved it so much. I'm like, Martha in the 80s and 90s was a vibe. Oh my gosh, was she a vibe?
100%. But then she started doing the cookbooks. And the thing was, is I didn't even realize this. I hadn't even thought about this. But before her, a lot of cookbooks didn't have photos in them. And she was like, it has to be in color. It has to have photos. You have to be like showing all of it. Like, it's not just a cookbook. It is like a way of living, like a lifestyle book is really what it was. And then she made a lifestyle book basically about weddings at the exact same time her marriage was falling apart. And I'm not going to lie, like just a piece of me, like my heart broke for her, because I can't imagine what it was like building a business at that time as a woman. I mean, her catering business, she grew it to over 1 million annual revenue. And then these cookbooks were wildly famous.
Yeah. So that is one thing I was actually thinking about as I was going through each different episode. So there's four episodes, you guys. And her Stewart is her married name. It is not her maiden name. And I wonder, because her marriage did not end good. Like, it was a pretty tumultuous divorce. There was a restraining order against her. And she built this entire empire, and it was not her own personal name. Can you imagine? Like, it had to have just kind of clawed at her a little bit, don't you think?
Oh, for sure. And I also just think about the irony of the fact that this woman was making her fortune with this like idealistic, like homemaking lifestyle at a time when women were like, you know, the feminist movement was beginning. Women were leaving home. And then here she is in the middle of this like horrible divorce. Like, all of those ironies during this documentary, what was that, like episode two maybe, was not lost on me. Like, it was kind of crazy.
Well, I think that's what actually makes me so in awe of Martha, is going back to what you just said about how she built all of this in a time when the movement was actually not for women to be in the house. Like, women were marching, women were protesting, women were like demanding their rights. And she was like, I'm going to go back to what women are trying to leave. And somehow she scaled that to what she did. And I think that just speaks volumes of not only her vision, but how she was able to carry out her vision. I mean, she's a woman that knew what she wanted, knew how to get it, and like was not going to stop going for it. One of the quotes that actually stood out to me was her husband. There was one of her staff caterers that was like asking for, I think it was a raise or something. And he was quoted as saying, Martha is going to be big as McDonald's and we're not giving any of it away. So like from day one, Martha knew what she wanted and she went for it. And it's admirable, but it's like kind of crazy too.
I think though she was like selling the idea of lifestyle and homemaking. Like one of the quotes I saw was from one of the execs on maybe one of her first TV shows that was like, you know, people in New York City are not out trimming their rose bushes. And she was like, yeah, but they want to be. Like she was selling this like idealistic lifestyle, but it's the idea, right? Like Martha was inspiring this idea of like what your life could be like.
Well, it just makes you think of like social media nowadays. Like that's why people like after this, I do think she'll be crowned like the OG influencer, the OG brand maker. I mean, going back to how she started with like the cookbooks and then moved into the magazines and then the TV show, like she knew, they talked so many times about how she knew it was important to build like an overall arching brand around herself. I just think she got things that she was like ahead of her time, essentially.
For sure, which probably has made her why she's like so wildly successful. So a little bit about the timeline that I thought was interesting was she had these cookbooks, then she got the deal with Kmart. And the Kmart deal is fascinating because I feel like if you saw her cookbooks, you would not be like, oh, she's the perfect candidate for Kmart and she needs to represent the brand of Kmart, right? Like even her friends in Connecticut supposedly were like, Kmart, like, you know, like a little bit of ick with it. But she absolutely like rode that wave. She made the company, I think they said like it rose to like a $30 billion company while she was quote unquote consulting for them or one of their brand ambassadors. And they hired a ton of celebrities, but Martha was the one that brought it home.
Yeah, because she went in there and she told them what to do. She bossed those people around. She was like, your linens are ugly. We're doing these colors. I'm not doing that color. Like she just, which is one thing I want to talk about is I did not realize she was polarized. Like people loved Martha and people did not love Martha. And I think I was always under the assumption that like everyone was team Martha, but she got a lot of hate, a lot of ridicule, a lot of people made fun of her. She was like on SNL skits all the time, like in like mockery. And a lot of it they said came down to kind of that personality she had where she was just like not cold, but not like warm, lighthearted, you know, fun. It's always says if everyone loves you, no one loves you, yeah. Right? Like you are not doing anything if you are appealing to everyone. And that's what I feel like really drove home for me, for Martha. Like you don't create waves of fans and like loyal people who love you if you're not speaking like so directly to someone that you're speaking the opposite language to someone else. And I feel like I was so reminded of that with Martha, where I was like, again, I don't know how, you know, arranging flowers and doilies and composting could make people so upset and angry. I think it probably had a stem to do with like her success as a female, because she was the first female self-made billionaire. And I think it has more to do with that, like a woman's success, than probably anything else.
Oh, so many things to say. When she became the first self-made woman billionaire, it was when her brand actually went public. And I was thinking that had to be like a full circle moment for her to be like, holy crap, I was a stockbroker and now I have a brand on like the stock exchange. Like that's wild.
She was making moves and she made it all the way up until she couldn't make any moves anymore. And she fell essentially like until her moves brought her downwards.
Yeah, so let's get into her downfall. She was accused of insider trading. And
did you know this? Did you remember that?
Yes, I remembered this. I couldn't remember when it was.
You know me. I just never pay attention to the news. And I knew she went to jail. I didn't know for how long. I didn't know what for, like none of that. So I was very intrigued at this part too. I think it was episode 3.
Can I tell you that I told my husband we were covering Martha Stewart and he didn't know who she was?
Oh my gosh, that shut up.
No, he was like, okay, I know she's some like magazine, like homemaking lady, but he was like, if she passed me on the street, I wouldn't know who she was. Like, if you showed me a picture and said, like, which one's Martha Stewart? He was like, I honestly know nothing about her. And so when I was watching the documentary, he kept being like, no, this is all new information to me. And I was like,
was he into it?
I don't know if I had him watch enough to really be into it, but I definitely was telling him about like her brand. I mean, you cannot not be fascinated by her brand. Like men out there, like this is not just a show for women. Like what she built is absolutely insane. So going back to the insider trading, one of the quotes I saw was that she could not like play dumb on this. She was a stockbroker. She knew what she was doing. Mm-hmm. And she lied about it. And she never even got charged for the insider trading. She got charged for lying about the insider trading, which I think is really weird about how that worked out. But she ended up going to jail for 5 months. And if she had not done this, she would have only lost $45,000. Like,
that is what stood out to me the most. This was all over $45,000. I was like, Martha, you probably made that in 2 weeks, a week, a day. I don't know. Like, who are you surrounding yourself that did not give you better advice? They're like, just eat it, Martha. Eat the 45K. Continue on your private jet down too. Because she was like flying. They talked about how she was mid-transport and touched down to refuel and got the phone call about like trading out the stocks. And it's like, just go enjoy your vacation. Eat 45K. Come back. Make another magazine or cookbook. Like, I just could not believe that's what it came down to. Like, I think my jaw dropped when the TV said $45,000 is what she would have lost if she wouldn't have sold her stocks.
I know. I kept thinking it was going to be like millions. And even then, like, you're a billionaire, like with a B. If you lost a couple million, like, she fought this for like 3 years, was in the news, like spread across the media, and then ended up in jail for 5 months, house arrest for 5 months, and then 2 year probation and a $30,000 fine. Like, and she would not give in, though. Like, she continued to lie about it over and over again. Like, but I do think it goes to her kind of personality of, she seems like a really intense person. You mentioned when she got divorced, her husband put a restraining order against her. Like, I mean, as fabulous as she is, she sounds like she could also just, you know, be a lot maybe. But the important part of her story, I think, is like where, how she came out and was like ready to go.
Yeah. Episode 4 was all about the rebrand, and, you know, you never get a bet against Martha. I feel like that's my takeaway. It's like,
so kidding.
You put your money on Martha, because a lot of people thought that was kind of the end of her. And I think it would have been the end of like 99% of people. Like, you know,
for sure.
I mean, she had to sell off her company. She went to jail. Like, I mean, it was a major trend downwards. I don't think the average person, and I don't think even the person above the average person would come back from that. Like, it is Martha and Martha alone that could come back and turn her life and another brand into what she has after what she, you know, experienced with going to jail.
It wasn't all like easy, though. When she first got out of jail, it was a little bit rocky, but I think a turning point was actually when she did a comedy roast against Justin Bieber. I did not remember this or know about this at all, but I'm absolutely going back to watch it because it looks hysterical. She freaking roasted Justin Bieber. And that was where she ended up meeting Snoop Dogg and like all these new partnerships. Her new personality, where she's actually really funny and like comedical, came out during this rebrand.
That was, I was reading like 3 tips to take from Martha. And one of them was that, like, learn to diversify, and our favorite word, pivot, and just like embrace changes in yourself and your brand and growth. And I think that's one thing like Martha did really well, looking, as you said, like what she was, how you associate with her before, and then kind of what she's being now. She has like CBD, she has a wine label, she has like all these different things. And I thought that was like such a cool takeaway to take from this.
Yeah, I agree.
On that note, I do have one thing before we wrap this up. I thought we could end with imparting wisdom from Martha, America's first self-made female billionaire. There's no one else I'd want to take it from, you know, a life model from. But she said that 2 things that have resounded throughout her career were, first, when you're through changing, you're through. So kind of just what I said, like continue to evolve. And then the second imparting wisdom from her is learn something new every day. And I thought that was, you know, from the words of Martha, from the mouth of Martha.
We are just ending these articles with solid advice from women. I mean, last week it was Dolly Parton's advice about potatoes. This week it is Martha giving us, you know, business advice. So there you have it, Discos.
By now, you know that Tara and I swear by Armra. It was one of our daily non-negotiables. We have been taking it for over a half a year now and continue to be impressed by the benefits we see from it.
So what is Armra? Armra is a bovine colostrum that harnesses over 400 living bioactive nutrients to rebuild the barriers of your body and fuel cellular health for a host of research-backed health benefits. From boosting our immune system to powerful anti-aging benefits to hair and skin radiance, Armra does it all.
And you guys, I have to share that I recently tried another colostrum on the market. And when I say Armra came out on top, Armra came out on top. What stood out to me compared to this alternative is that Armra didn't clump, it tasted better, and it even had a better smell to it too.
If you want to try Armra for yourself, go to tryarmra.com/discover or enter code discover to get 15% off your first order. Or you can click the link in our show notes and enter code discover to save some money.
All right, diving into the second article to discover this week, headline, these strawberries cost $780. Are they worth it? Produce is expensive these days, but the luxury Japanese strawberries, Kokoda, Wayuki, and Pearl White are on a whole nother level.
Yeah, these fruits are priced like Michelin star restaurants. They're outrageous.
They're like a house rent, a monthly house rent.
Seriously, car payment, house rent, all rolled into one. So one of them was starting at only $89 for 500 grams. I'm not going to lie, I don't really know how much 500 grams is, but it feels like not a lot of strawberries for $90.
It's weird to put it in that measurement as well. Like, are we dealing illegal strawberries? Like, are these illegal strawberries? Are they coming in a plastic baggie? You know, like, it's so weird to see like 500 grams of strawberries. It's like you're dealing, are you getting them behind a building? You know, are they getting slid to you?
Well, and considering they're called pearl white strawberries, I have a lot of questions about what is happening to these strawberries. Okay, then the prices go up from there. This one is in per pack, so that seems a little more reasonable, but it's $128, so not so reasonable. And then the variety set that includes 27 strawberries is $780. And that is all before they even ship to you from Japan.
I know, and I guarantee it's not free shipping, and it's not free returns either. So if you order these, you better be dang sure you want them.
If you don't like them, the return policy is zero.
Just when we thought Erewhon prices were bad, this article kind of like brought a whole new light to me. But I did think it has obviously a lot to do with like cultural differences.
For sure.
Like, I feel like that's kind of like a main undertone here, because the article highlighted how luxury fruit is like a thing in Japan. So they talked about this, I guess you call it like a brand, a store. It's like the Sembikia. And it is the most expensive fruit shop in the world. They called it the Tiffany's of fruits. And I think that's obviously like a very foreign concept to us. But to them and their culture, it isn't. Like that's the way they operate.
I love how you just like glided right over the pronunciation of that brand. Way to go. So on the podcast.
Well, I did until you brought it to surface.
Well, so far on this podcast, we have taught you guys French. Now we're dipping our toes in Japanese. Like, just bear with us through all these pronunciations.
We are multilingual. This is a multilingual podcast. It's funny, though, because when I was like reading that I saw that it was the Tiffany of fruits, I was like, you know, I'll just take the Tiffany or the Birkin bag. Like, I'll take the goods, you know, like... I don't know if I want the luxury Tiffany strawberries, but that's just me.
So getting into kind of the culture, as you said, I actually Daniel and I went to Japan for our honeymoon, and we spent a few days in Tokyo. And I will say, if there's one thing I left there thinking, was like how unique and incredible their culture is. Like, we went to the National Sumo Wrestling Competition, and talk about something that is like all culture. If there was that much culture at our football games, I guarantee no one would watch. Like, it was all about who bowed and who did what, and like how you just like thank, you know, everything was just so incredible to see. And so this was really like no different for me. I was like, oh, this totally makes sense.
I'm trying to imagine you, like teeny tiny Tara, at a sumo wrestling event. Like, you could probably not have looked more petite and smaller than there in that environment.
whenever I was getting ready to go to Tokyo, I read some like articles. Obviously, this is, you know, back a long time ago. I feel like Google was still not readily available on my phone. So I was reading articles before we went, and it was like, oh, you know, expect for people to stop you on the street if you're American because you're so tall. And I was like, I don't think.
Nope.
I'm not going to check that box.
swing and a miss.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I fit in. I'm actually pretty, I'm short here too. I'm universally.
Yeah, don't know if you fit in. I think that's also a swing and a miss.
Yeah. So on this culture part of it, a huge part of the culture in Japan is gift giving. And so, you know, there's different seasons. They have like two seasons. They said one in July and one in December. That's big gift giving season. And they actually compared it to like giving wines. And before they even said that, that's exactly where my mind went. How is this any different than someone giving a really expensive bottle of wine to a family member or a friend for, you know, some kind of celebration that you're having?
And yeah, with the gift giving, one thing that stood out to me, like when I was actually went to this website and was like, visually looking at the fruit, and like presentation is huge as part of it, because like you said, it is given for gift, which is, I mean, one little umbrella under cost. Like why this actually costs so much is because they put so much in the presentation. They talked about like the, you know, certain melons were packaged in like chic gold embossed boxes, and the strawberries literally looked like a box of chocolate presentations. Like they almost like it was, I don't, they looked fake. Like they were so perfect, like the Pantone hues, which they talked about. I mean, it's absolutely meant as a gift. Again, I think I'd be like, I'll take the money in a card. Just give me the card and the money. But, you know, to each their own. There might be some people that want to, like, you know, indulge in this kind of fruit, I guess.
I feel like the difference between this and a nice bottle of wine is if you're a wine collector and someone gives you a nice like $1,000 bottle of wine, say, you probably would display it for a while. You'd save it for a special occasion. You know, it may be in your wine cellar. I don't know, something like you have to eat these strawberries this week or they're going bad, right? Like that's it. It's such a quick gift. And I think that was where I struggled with the entire thing of like, okay, it is similar to giving a bottle of wine, but not quite.
Well, and like you said, you just eat it so quickly. Like I've seen my child eat strawberries and it's like, you know, you slurp them down. Actually, could you imagine if you had these like sitting in your fridge and your child got into them and like ate your $1,000 strawberries and you didn't even get a chance to eat them? Oh my gosh, I would die.
Today, actually, my daughter was in charge of cutting like the tops off the strawberries. And I am not kidding when I say there was like 4 strawberries left when she was done. And I was like, okay. We're taking this chore away from you. We have no strawberries for the rest of the week.
You're like, no ikigai fruits for you. No ikigai fruits for you, Annalise.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of ikigai, I was not at all surprised, actually, that this was the name of the company, because I was first introduced to the idea of ikigai actually at Rural Rooted. And what ikigai means, it is the Japanese... it's like a saying. It's the reason to live. That's what ikigai means. And it is basically where people, you know, discover what truly matters to them and live a life with purpose and joy. And so that is the name of one of these strawberry companies, is Ikigai.
Yeah, their website said behind every fruit, there's a farmer with an ikigai. And they really lean into this and talk about, again, this goes into the cost portion. And part of the reason why they say their fruit is so expensive is because, like, to their farmers, fruit farming is their ikigai. It's like what they are meant to do, which is why it's the best in the world. And they talk about how these farmers have to like hand pollinate, hand water. They massage the fruits, apparently. Like they polish the melons, like all of these different things.
When you read massage the strawberries, what do you think that entails exactly?
I don't know, but I feel like if you massaged it too hard, you'd like panic. Like you're like, if I break it, do I have to buy the strawberry?
I cannot afford like, my own strawberry.
Massage gone wrong on aisle 4. It's just not a good day at work.
No, I totally get like hand pollinating, hand watering, the massaging and polishing of the fruit. It had me thrown.
Yeah, but they say, I mean, to the farmers, fruit farming is their reason for living. So, I mean, they eat, breathe, sleep. They probably put a cot in there. They talked about how they have like an analysis of sugar content, flavor, ripeness, and appearance. Like everything is into this. I still don't buy, though, that it can be $1,000 to do that kind of like, I guess, devotion to the fruit. I'm still a little bit like, really?
I mean, did you read the part where they offer shading on each individual fruit? So they basically put a hat on the strawberry so the plant continues to get sunlight, but the strawberry doesn't get overly sunned. I was like, wow.
You're like, what are you doing today? And you're like, I gotta go hat my strawberries.
I know. I literally was like, these people take more care and devotion to their strawberries than maybe someday
than we do our children. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm gonna use this as like the next time I want to get out of an event though. They're gonna be like, oh, do you need, you know, Luke's gonna, my extroverted husband will be like, oh, we have an event to go to. I'll be like, strawberries in the garden. I gotta go hat them. You know, I think massage. I haven't massaged my strawberries for a few days. I really think they're past due for a good massage. So I'm out on tonight, you know?
Before you started talking about the garden, I was envisioning you out there with like an umbrella by like the cows. Shading the cows this summer. It was like so freaking hot here today. So maybe that's just where my mind went, but I get to see you out with the cows. You're like giving a back massage to the mama cows and like, sorry, Luke, not tonight. Can't go to dinner.
I really want to, but you know, can't.
Okay. But in all seriousness, if the $780 strawberries are not in your budget, there are a couple budget friendly options. I actually went to Erewhon and saw if they had them online and they did not. So that was not an option, but there is a few berries that you can buy from an indoor vertical grow farm in New Jersey. So if you're located on the East Coast, you can get more budget friendly luxury fruits.
Yeah, that brand, Oishi Berries, is actually going viral right now on TikTok. I've seen reels of it and TikToks of it, and it is $50 a pack and is now down to like the $12 a pack range. So definitely tiers below the Japanese Ikigai brand. I thought it'd be kind of fun to try it, honestly. One thing I kept thinking when I was reading this is obviously going back to like luxury fruit and, you know, just like perfection almost in a fruit. It was like screaming to me, obviously, the exact opposite of another big movement we have right now, which is like eat the ugly fruit, you know, like consume ugly produce. Like we have obviously a big, you know, waste problem. And I thought it was so, I guess, interesting, for lack of a better word, that they could position themselves in this manner with that same like movement happening on the exact opposite end of the spectrum.
Do you want to know what I think it is? I think it's cultural differences. Again, I think where you value a strawberry so much and the work a farmer does that you're willing to pay $780 for that strawberry. I mean, maybe if you can pay that much, you would waste it, but I don't think so. I think you're like valuing what you're given. I feel like sometimes with food being so cheap in the United States and so abundant, it's almost like a throwaway for us. Like we do not value, we don't place a value. You know how when something's free, there's no value on it and you don't appreciate it. I feel like sometimes that's the way that as an American like culture, we value food with very little value because it is so inexpensive to us.
It's like trying to, it's like, it makes me think of like earning your dollar of like a teenager, like spending money, essentially, you know, like how you spend your money when you have to work harder for it. And when it like doesn't come as easy, you obviously value it a much more.
Yeah, definitely. The final thing I will say is that if you are really looking for a dupe, you know how you see like Lululemon dupes on Amazon, you can get a dupe at your local grocery store for these strawberries. You can get the Driscoll strawberries, and they breed rosé strawberries and rosé raspberries, which I actually was thinking maybe I would try.
Have you seen those before? I was like, I've never seen those before.
No, never. But I feel like if I'm vacationing in California or something, I'll try to like scope them out and actually see if they have them. But I highly doubt rural New Mexico is getting rosé strawberries and rosé raspberries, but I could be eating my words. Who knows?
I just think I'm going to work on manifesting to get on the PR list of the Ikigai fruit so that we can try it out for the discos. Let them know.
All right, you start working on that. When it comes to insurance, we all get insurance hoping we never have to use it. But in those times that we do need it, we want a business that we can trust and people that we know, not a big faceless company. AgSure is exactly what we want. It is a small family-owned insurance company that exclusively serves the agribusiness community. The agency started about 20 years ago with the vision of being the go-to property, liability, and workers' compensation insurance experts, addressing the unique challenges and needs of modern agribusiness. My family has been using AgSure for years, and the whole AgSure team is amazing to work with. AgSure understands agribusiness, provides information in a clear and understandable format, minimizes interruption, and has carrier options. And when you have questions or need help, it's a real person, a person you know and trust that picks up the phone. The current insurance market is in flux with higher premiums, less coverage, and higher deductibles. There are opportunities to get creative with coverage to match farmers' needs while still addressing the risk. AgSure looks forward to showing their experience in finding the right places to save and matching customers with the insurance company that will best fit their risk profile. If you are interested in receiving a quote or learning more, you can go to aginsurance.com. And if you want more than a website, we also put their phone number in the show notes. Okay, we know how obsessed everyone is with sourdough bread right now, but maybe you want that homemade bread feeling without all of the work. The sourdough starter, the feeding, the proofing, all of it. Well, Wild Grain is a subscription box for you. Wild Grain was founded by a husband and wife team, and it's the first bake-from-frozen delivery service for sourdough breads, pastries, and hand-cut fresh pasta. We just had the pasta for the first time last night, and it was amazing. With Wild Grain, you can expect real sourdough, clean ingredients, and support small bakeries. There are so many great choices to fill your box, but some of our favorites include the croissants. I love the chocolate croissants, and Natalie and Luke love the English muffins for breakfast sandwiches, and both of our kids love the waffles for breakfast. I could literally go on and on about Wild Grain, but if you want to try it for yourself, use code DISCOVER and save yourself some money on your next order. And fun fact, for every new member, Wild Grain donates 4 meals to the Greater Boston Food Bank. Again, that's code DISCOVER at Wild Grain.
All right, diving into the last and final article to discover this week, headline, Lunchables Under Fire. Consumer Reports is calling for the removal of Lunchables from school trays across the country after discovering concerning levels of lead and sodium and a potentially harmful chemical in their packaging.
The first thing I'll say, there was a quote in one of the articles that said, "The popular snack may not be the healthiest option for growing kids." And I had to stop and think, is there a point we thought Lunchables were a healthy option for kids? And I realize healthy and being like contaminated with lead are two different things. But the way some of this was positioned left me like scratching my head just a little bit.
No, I was like, to no surprise, right? Like some of these headlines, again, centered around health, like not talking about the safety component of it, but the ones that were like gearing on like kind of the health of Lunchables. I was like, well, duh, like obvi. I don't know. Like that's on you. I'm sorry. If you were going in and thinking the Lunchables was your healthy option, like we have bigger problems maybe to talk about, you know, like I think it's pretty safe to assume that most of us are aware. I mean, and that comes down to like even what we're saying last week with Chick-fil-A and fast food. It's like people don't go into them. I would say most average people don't go into those places and place their orders thinking they're getting like quote unquote like healthy meals. It's they're choosing it for a different reason. Lunchables is no different. It's for the convenience.
Yeah, and I'm not casting any shade on Lunchables. I have absolutely had Lunchables for my kids, served them to my kids. Like, I am not, like, food shaming any parent out there. I just want that to be said. But I am doing it for convenience, not because I think it's the healthiest option I can give my kids.
So, did you get Lunchables growing up?
Maybe occasionally. I don't know. I don't remember them really being, a staple or anything. I think here and there, but that's it. What about you?
So do you know how you always joke that your mom was like the Pinterest mom before Pinterest moms? Wow. My mom was like the homesteading mom before like
homesteading
Instagram homesteading moms. Like she made our own bread. She milled our own flour. Like we didn't get sugary cereals. It was like my mom, food has always been, I would say, like a core component of our house. And my mom always like really focused on good food. And when I was younger, I would have given anything to eat a Lunchable and get a Lunchable for my lunch. That and Gushers. Those were like the two things I wanted. I like remember begging my mother, like, can I please just have a Lunchable or a Gusher? And it was like, no.
Golly, no. Gushers were just so freaking good, though. Like, they still are. I feel like I can't even buy Gushers because I would just eat the entire box now as an adult. Like, I would have no self-control.
Fruit roll-ups? No. Fruit roll-ups, like, right down the hatch. Like, you just all, I could pound six of them. Six in a box, unroll them, pound them. Same with Gushers. They're so good. They're, like, staples of, I don't know what, 90s kids.
Getting back to this, the concern is that there are troublingly high levels of lead, sodium, and ketamine. That is what everyone's concerned about. And these are being served in our public school lunches. They're a part of our like lunch program. I will say one side note, the store-bought option is different than the Lunchables in the schools because the school has to meet certain whole grain requirements, sodium levels, all these different things.
So that is something I wanted to go for our disco community to, because I am so curious if you know your school system is actually serving a Lunchable. Like, is yours? I was like, I don't know if I believe that. Like, I know it was allowed and they like passed it so that it could be, but I'm like, are schools actually serving that? Like, I'm so, if you're a disco and you have seen a school or know of a school, please let us know. I'm so curious. Go, you know, we always are checking our DMs. So go DM us on our Instagram page.
Well, and what's absolutely bonkers to me about this is, let me remind you, we cannot serve whole milk in schools because it's considered unhealthy.
Let the New Mexico milkmaid remind you.
It's wild what's allowed.
It is wild.
The advocacy group Consumer Reports tested 12 store-bought Lunchable products. So there, but again, there is going to be some differences between the two, but they were testing store-bought ones.
So to the note of testing by the Consumer Report, and I'm just going to say that more clearly for you guys. The Consumer Reports is like the profit watchdog that ran this report. They're the ones that are like calling the whistle. It's all because of Consumer Reports. I guess they just like do this every once in a while, like with testing of food and all different things. So I don't think it's like a regular thing. I don't know why they chose Lunchables. To that note, though, that's part of the problem a lot of people are talking about. Well, not a lot of people, but the right people are talking about, is that the Consumer Reports didn't talk about the testing. They tested this and said they tested it, but they didn't talk about their methods. They didn't give any numbers. They didn't give any data. They basically just tested it and then said, we're concerned. And a lot of people are picking that. Well, again, not a lot of people. The right people are picking that apart.
Yeah, to get into the data, I want to make it clear, none of the kits exceeded any legal or regulatory limit. This report also did what so many reports do, is that they reported in percentages instead of actual numbers. And I say that while addressing the fact that like most people think no lead at all, that there should be absolutely no lead in anything when serving it to kids. But the percentages make it seem so much worse than actually giving numbers.
Yeah, so there's actually this account, you guys. I'm going to share him to our Instagram stories, too. So if you're looking for him, like if lead is kind of like a thing that interests you and you want more about him, his name is Eric Everything Lead. And he is actually like a professional, I guess, like lead tester. I don't know, lead scientist, something. He has a credible name, is a credible source that I am not verbally communicating properly right now. But he did a reel on this talking about this Lunchable example, and I was watching it, and he called Consumer Reports out so much for this because he said this is a tactic they continually do, which is talk in percentages, because it is really hard for our brains, like unless you are in the scientific mathematical world all the time, like percentages, we don't think that way. And you can give bigger percentages for a more like wowing effect when really, like we've talked about this in so many different examples, where they'll be like, it's a 74% increase. But like when you break it down, it was like two more, you know, studies or two more people or something. Like the difference between numbers and percentages is vastly different when you're talking about like data from scientific reports. And he said Consumer Reports does this all the time. They'll talk in percentages for the headline, for the wow fact, and never in numbers, so that one, people can't like fact check it, and two, it just comes across like wowing. Like we can't process it in our heads. We just hear the 74% and then like panic.
Yeah, I found his page actually whenever the whole lead in Stanley Cups was going crazy, and he took apart the Stanley Cup and tested it for lead. And so he gives really good information, just like breaks down all the facts. So I actually loved him for this one as well. Another one that was really helpful for kind of, I don't want to say debunking, but just giving factual information was also Food Science Babe. She did a breakdown of this and gave fantastic information.
Of course. Our fairy godmother, the Food Science Babe, not to be confused with the Food Babe.
Yeah.
You want science in the middle. You want to make sure science is part of the handle. And the content.
You know what's so funny is when we were researching for South by Southwest, we talked a little bit about like the Food Babe and had some examples from her in our presentation. And I could not find her Instagram page. And I was like, so did she take it down? Like, what happened? I'm so confused. No, I'm blocked. She blocked me. So I can't see her Instagram page.
Oh, that's right. Because I was like, no, it's like active and thriving. I'm like, she's going viral right now for Chick-fil-A.
You were like, she's going viral. And I was like, that's impossible. She doesn't have an Instagram page. And then I was like, oh, yeah, I'm blocked.
I am part of the group that is blocked by the Food Babe.
So to reiterate, go to Food Science Babe because she has a really great reel on this as well and gets into all the doses and all of those things. And one of the things that she talks about is that the 74% that they quote is based on the California's maximum allowable dose level. One thing to know about that maximum allowable dose level is that that level was set because people would experience no effect even if people were exposed to 1,000 times more than that amount. That's how they set those results. So it's kind of crazy. I mean, it's a very, very small number.
Well, so that was one thing she talked a lot about too, is that like technically no... there's no safe amount, but like zero threshold is unrealistic. And so working off of what we have, because people are like, well, we shouldn't have lead anyway, right? You know, like that's like kind of one of the arguments. But like, I think something we should talk about and point out is that like the lead is in, it's coming from our soils. Like that is what is in our soils. And it's not because like soil is bad. It's like, I mean, it has to do with like sedentary rock and where you are geographically. Like there are heavy metals in our soil. Like fruits and vegetables have heavy metals in them. Everything has like a little bit of trace of it. And so to go to like zero amount is just completely unrealistic when you're having this conversation. Like, no, we're not proponents for like lead in our food, but two things. One, because it's in the soil, like naturally occurring, like it's almost impossible to avoid it. And two, I think the way, again, like these headlines and the way this Consumer Report is making this come out, it's like, it makes it seem like we're putting lead in the food, or Lunchables is like putting lead in the food. And like, again, there's that fear and that fear mongering that you and I absolutely hate when it comes to the food system, instead of having like a logical conversation about like, well, it's naturally occurring. And like, this is like, you know, the nuance. It's always lacking the nuance. It comes down to nuance.
One of the nuances that I think was so important is that only processed foods are tested for lead. They do not test whole foods. So we don't have regular data given to us about how much lead is in fruits and vegetables. And I'm not saying that to like scare people away from fruits and vegetables. It's just the reality of something we need to consider, that there's going to be trace amounts of lead in everything. And one of those accounts, maybe, I don't remember whether it was Food Science Babe or the lead guy, but in the Lunchables, they feel like some of it actually came from like spices and things used for coloring. And like, you just don't think about all the things that go into the food of where it could be. I think people see, like you said, lead in Lunchables and think Lunchables is just contaminating their food. And there was actually a really great quote from one of the people at Kraft Heinz. And he gave a statement that said, all of our food meet strict safety standards that we happily feed to our own families. And I just thought that was like something to kind of consider. I mean, not saying we trust every CEO and everything they ever say, but again, someone's not just like adulterating the Lunchables on purpose.
Yeah. So do you think, will you stop feeding your kids Lunchables since you feed them Lunchables?
So I have not done Lunchables since we moved to homeschooling. A big thing for me was on days that I just did not have time to like make their lunch that morning is usually when they'd get a Lunchable. And I would say it was probably once a week or so. It was not every day. And so now that we homeschool, they make their own lunches kind of. I mean, I help them obviously, but we're just making lunch together, right? Like I'm making my lunch, that we're making lunch. And so we haven't, yeah. I probably haven't bought them now in 9 months. Would I stop giving them? Probably not, but maybe I would just be slightly more conscientious of how often I would give it. But I feel like that already was in the back of my mind. Going back to our very first point,
right?
I was not picking Lunchables because I was like, oh, this is so healthy. I'm so glad I'm giving my kid this. It was like, I am, you know, leaving on a work trip and I just need to make my life easier today. Here's a Lunchable for lunch.
Yeah. Eric Everything Led in his reel talked about how, so if you are a parent, a disco parent that does, you know, eat Lunchables yourself or give them to your kids, it talked about how I think it was like 5+ Lunchables you'd have to eat every single day to like get into the cautionary zone, like for concerns of lead, if that helps put it in a perspective for people who, like Tara, do want to continue, you know, occasionally providing, serving up a Lunchable. So as we wrap this up, I am completely shocked that we had this entire conversation around Lunchables and you have yet to talk about a charcuterie board, which is basically the adult version of a Lunchable, because you absolutely thrive on charcuterie boards. Like, I can't believe it hasn't come up yet.
I literally was thinking in my head as you were giving your last statement, I can't believe I didn't even talk about charcuterie boards and how I probably had Lunchables as a kid, because now I'm low-key obsessed with charcuterie
boards. Obsessed with charcuterie boards.
Which is exactly the same thing. Like, just adult charcuterie boards. Totally. Well, now I like want a charcuterie board for dinner this week. So fully expect that from me. Check my stories. It's coming this week. So as always, to close this out, we want to get your guys' feedback. I have a feeling this lead one is going to be very polarizing, probably as polarizing as Martha Stewart was in the 90s and still is today.
Man, we hit some hot potato topics this week.
Hot potato topic.
Martha and Lunchables.
Lunchables. Who would have guessed those two things would be in the same? Martha is probably like dying knowing. I mean, if she's a disco, which she probably is, she's probably dying a little bit to know that she was on the same episode as Lunchables. But anyway, give us your thoughts about lead and Lunchables. Are you stopping feeding them to your kids? Were you never feeding them to begin with? Or are you just carrying on with life in general and accepting that, you know, there's some level of risk in everything you eat and do? We want to hear from you. So leave us some DMs, send us your stories over on Instagram this week. And with that, we will see you guys next week.
This has been a 58 Ember production. For more shows, please visit the 58 Ember channel, 58ember.com, or find us at 58 Ember Media on socials.